Hello, dear listener. This is P.L. McMillan, author of Sisters of the Crimson Vine, and you are listening to the H.P. Lovecast podcast.
Hello, and welcome to HP Lovecast Presents Transmissions, where we collect brief interviews with creators with new or upcoming projects. We'll open up the guest reading an excerpt from their project and then follow with the interview proper. Transmissions posts on the last day of each month. I'm Nicholas Dyack. I'm a pop culture scholar of Peplum films, industrial music, horror studies, and I'm the editor of The New Peplum from McFarland.
And I am Michelle Brittany, editor of James Bond in Popular Culture, and the Bram Stoker-nominated Horror in Space. I write on all things pop culture with a special emphasis on horror, fantasy, and spy genres. Nicholas and I co-edited Horror Literature from Gothic to Postmodern, also from McFarland.
Today's transmission is with dark fiction and horror author Chelsea Pumpkins. Based in the New England area, Chelsea is a writer of short stories such as Cocoon, which appears in Bloodless, an anthology of blood-free horror, and Toxic Shock, which appears in Chromophobia, a strange house anthology by women in horror. She's also an editor who spearheaded the recently released anthology, Ah, That's What I Call Horror, an anthology of 90s horror. Welcome, Chelsea.
All right, this is a reading from my short story, Who in the World is the Hat Man? The blood recedes from your fingers and toes as Lindsay's words reverberate through your inner ear. They call him the Hat Man. Your heart flutters like a wounded moth, bouncing about your chest cavity before falling into your stomach. You hear your name. It's distant, garbled, as if coming from underwater. A red swordtail appears from the porthole of a sunken pirate ship in the fish tank across the room. Bubbles gurgle out of a treasure chest. You hear the call of your name again, but you're entranced by a tetra fish as it dances with the plastic algae swaying in the current. Hey, Lindsay's voice, clear now, annoyed. What's wrong with you? Huh? The dark basement comes back into focus. Nothing, I'm fine, you reply. You sure? You're shaking, Rachel says, her face contorted in concern. What's the matter? You're not afraid of the Hat Man, are you? Lindsay chides, wagging her flashlight beneath her chin. The beam reflects off her braces, casts sinister shadows onto her face. You're not going to call your mom again, are you? Muffled giggles tease from the dark behind Lindsay. Not going to call your big brother. I said I'm fine, Lindsay. Your speech is uneven. The trembling of your lips trips your words. The giggles transform into snickers, growing in both volume and ridicule. Don't worry, Rachel whispers, reaching for your hand. It's just a dumb story. Make believe. I know, you say, I'm fine. You swallow the burning coal in your throat and clutch the edge of your brother's G.I. Joe sleeping bag. You hate G.I. Joe and loathe hand-me-downs. Next to the girls' 101 Dalmatians and My Little Pony bags, the faded army greens make you stick out even more. But Justin's sour scent lingers in its folds and his smell is a refuge. You haven't felt safe since he moved out to live with your uncle across the state, since he started coming around.
We're joined tonight by Chelsea Pumpkins, editor of That's What I Call Horror. Welcome, Chelsea. It's great to see you.
Hi, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Yeah. Well, you have an edited collection that came out a couple months ago called That's What I Call Horror. It's all about 90s era horror. So we got to ask, how did this anthology come about, and aside from capturing the 90s, what's the big thing you want to accomplish with it?
So this anthology is a little bit different than some of the typical horror anthologies you see out there in how it came about, because I'm a part of a few different kind of writing communities online. A lot of us talk on Discord, which is kind of like Slack if you're not familiar. A few of us were just kind of talking about, hey, it'd be cool to put something together. We decided let's make an anthology and pick a theme and kind of all write some stories around it. and put it out. So it started off a bit experimental. We all picked the theme together. We like voted on the title. Once we picked 90s, we all kind of started brainstorming ideas. So none of us really stepped on each other's toes too much in like content or like kind of subgenre and that type of thing. So I would say like in terms of what we were trying to accomplish, like a little bit just like kind of having fun. Like we just wanted to write some stories we were excited about and put out a product. I think in part to like kind of see if we could do it and see how it would go, and in part just to like get another publication out there. So I think I've explained this. I think I explained this in the acknowledgments, but for those who have not read the acknowledgments, because I know not everybody likes them.
People don't like acknowledgments? That's a fun. The front matter is always.
I love reading acknowledgments. But yeah, some people skip it. They're like, I'm at the end of the book. I don't care. But so once we all, there was 14 of us in the end, a few people were involved along the way that couldn't finish their story or couldn't like just kind of had to drop out because of life. Once we, all of our stories were done and we started kind of getting into the like putting a book together phase, it got a little bit harder for 14 people to weigh in on everything. At least in our group, we kind of embodied by accident like the 90s attitude. So where we're just like, ah, yeah, whatever, it'll get done. Like we kind of joked that we became like 90s slackers. But I do have a natural tendency to sort of project manage and kind of herd cats. And as you guys have a lot of cats, you might understand that analogy pretty well. So some people were like, hey, why don't we just appoint somebody to kind of take this over the finish line, like with our support, of course. And they're like, Chelsea, you've been doing a lot of the work, so do you want to do it? And I was like, yeah, sure, I'll take a stab. I like learning new things. And that's kind of how it all came about. And yeah, I mean, at the time there wasn't much like current 90s horror stuff out there. But there does seem to be a little bit of a taste for nostalgia, like at least in movies and shows and stuff right now. So we were like, let's do the 90s. So in terms of accomplishing that, we're like, hey, let's tap into this era that's a little bit untouched right now. And then also just get some writing out there. So
obviously you've been a part of anthologies before, writing essays or, you know, stories for those. But as you said, you were kind of appointed the project manager for this one.
Yes.
Since you were kind of herding the other writers, what were some of the obstacles that you encountered putting together a horror collection? And what were some of the important lessons that you learned?
Yeah, it's way different than just being a writer who gets selected and published. Like that is a much more hands-off experience. And I will say, like, because we're all writer colleagues or friends, like working with the authors directly was very easy. So I don't know if that's a hurdle that other editors face, because we all already knew each other. I'm like, you can't ignore me. I know where to find you. Like we had kind of agreed on like terms and like agreements and payments and that kind of thing, like ahead of time before I even took over. So like some of that harder stuff was kind of already like under the radar. But I will say like some things that I didn't necessarily anticipate. Making a timeline is very difficult in publishing. And I know that seems like it should be like the first thing you do, but even just picking a publication date, like when you pick it, it's very arbitrary. Like I remember we at one point had talked like, well, let's not do it like around the holidays, cause that's like too crazy. Like let's do it right after the holidays. And then we were kind of like looking at like, I don't know, is Martin Luther King Jr. a weird weekend to like announce a book and like stuff like that. And then also factoring the amount of time that had to go into making it all work. But there's so many unforeseen things that come up. So I would say like, even on our release date, our paperback wasn't ready. And I think a lot of people would probably be a little bit embarrassed about that, but I was kind of just like, look, I didn't know what I didn't know. We did our best. I want this product to look fantastic. So I don't want to, basically what thing that slowed us down was, we had some cover issues in our proof that we got that needed to be fixed. It's okay. I'm glad we ordered a proof. I'm glad we caught it. I could have easily just skipped that step. and just hit print and go, and it would have come out on time, but I would have been unhappy with the product. So it was worth it to be a few weeks late on the paperback. People still got their ebooks for that to happen. So timelines are tough. If someone else is taking this over, I would say, like, put in so much buffer room, like, more than seems like you need, and then, like, kind of just stay on task as you go along. The systems that we used too were, like, there's definitely a learning curve to things. So, like, in order to physically put the book together, you have to use certain softwares. Then in order to publish it, you have to, like, make accounts and navigate their systems and all of that. I was very fortunate to have a lot of people around me who have published things before, and they offered tons of advice. They lent their accounts to me, and, like, I had, like, Zoom calls with people, like, telling me about Book Sirens, telling me about Draft to Digital. Like, Carson Winter helped with all the vellum formatting and stuff. So not every editor is going to be surrounded by people who can help. So I feel very, very fortunate that people knew what they were doing and also were so generous with their time. Promotion, huge hustle. You have to like that part, I would say. Like, I've talked to some people who are like, I'm interested in self-publishing. And I'm like, do you like being annoying online? Because that's what you need to do to sell your book. I had to, like, warn my, you know, like, not writer friends and family, like, I'm going to be so annoying on social media. First of all, please buy my book. Second of all, just mute me if I'm pissing you off.
I swear I'm not an MLM person. This is my
book,
not Herbalife.
I know. And, like, I thought it was fun. I think one thing about having a 90s themed book is, like, it lent itself really well to, like, memes and, like, bringing up, like, old memories. And, like, we would do, like, little giveaways where I'm like, tell me your favorite, you know, 90s memory or, like, your favorite album. And I felt pretty proud of the thing we did with the author photos, which is we got a photo of everybody involved in the book from the 90s of themselves. So that was a fun project for me. But, like, that is something where, like, if you don't like interacting with strangers online, like, that might not be for you and might be worth outsourcing it. But yeah, I think those are, like, kind of the main lessons I've learned. Amazon has, like, still to this day been a hurdle. We published through Draft to Digital, and something has been, like, disconnected between them and Amazon for a paperback, where, like, third parties have kind of taken over the listing. So it's, like, listed at too high of a price, but I also work full time, and I'm like, you know what? You can buy the book in 1,000 other places. So, like, whatever. I can't, like, dig into it at the moment, but there's always something. But for the most part, it's something that's been really fun.
That's really cool, though, that, you know, you had the camaraderie in your network that was able to hook you up with, you know, access, logins, and product and stuff like that. Not a lot of people have the network to do that. You know, sometimes we feel like an island when, especially mm-hmm. if you're going out in the self-publishing world. So,
oh, yeah.
You know, even doing all the self-research and whatnot out there, you still feel like, could be a little lost. So very, very cool that the stars were right for you, and that you had a really good, you know, team and contributors as well.
Yes, yeah, for sure. And, like, if I had to start from scratch on all of those different pieces, it would have taken me probably, like, an extra, like, 5 or 6 months to get this out the door. So super appreciative. They all know who they are. I love you all. Thank you so much.
Well, you kind of hinted at it a little bit ago that, you know, the 90s aren't so much tapped into right now. I think we're still riding the, you know, the 80s nostalgia wave, you know, synth wave and, you know, retro TV shows. I don't see as much love for the 90s. You know, I listen to vaporwave music, so that's about really it. So I don't, even though the 90s gave us, like, Scream and a lot of milestones in horror, I just don't see it in pop culture as much. So I guess after doing the book and also growing up in the 90s, you know, why don't you think the 90s are, like, as mined as much as, like, the 80s are? And what aspects of the 90s do you think are unique that, you know, you would like to see in, like, some newer wave of retro stories?
I think so. To give a little bit of perspective, I was very young in the 90s. I was like, you know, 1 through 10. So I have a totally different perspective than some other people, which also made the anthology a lot of fun because we're all different kind of ages and stuff. And you could see like some people pulled influences from different areas. I don't have like a super strong theory on why it's not tapped into. I think like my best guess is that it just has to do with timing, and like we might just be kind of finishing wrapping up with like idolizing the 80s and kind of getting into like, well, now the 90s were like, I don't know what, 30 years ago. So now, like now it's almost just like every nostalgia round like gets its time. And I think you can kind of see it like, I was thinking of Yellow Jackets, like that's a really popular show right now. And that is half in the 90s, half in modern day. And then one of the Fear Street movies was like, I think it was 99 or 96 or something like that. But I'm like, there are some things starting to pop up. There is another anthology coming out that I'm actually a part of that is R.L. Stein inspired as well. So that's like kind of coming in on the 90s thing too. There's another anthology call out right now, like Nirvana inspired horror. So I'm like, okay, now we're getting like some grunge. But so I do think it's like maybe just kind of coming into the beginning of it and we'll see more of it. I think fashion is a big indicator as well. I know this isn't a fashion podcast, but kind of just seeing like what the new generation's getting into. And it is a lot of the stuff we did in the 90s. Like, I can't believe the wide leg jeans are back. We're all like, girls, we suffered through the rain in these so that you didn't have to. But like the jeans, the platforms, like, I mean, my makeup tonight's insane. Like, it is kind of coming back around. So I think, I don't know. Hopefully our timing was good. I remember when we were making it, we're like, some other anthologies were kind of in the works. And we're like, how's the market like competition going to be? And then we're like, whatever, let's just go for it and not worry about it. And I think it worked out, but I don't know. Do you have any better theories? I'm just like, I don't know, timing.
I think the 90s lack a visual cue that the 80s have. But the weird thing is the 80s didn't stop in the 80s. They bled into the 90s. Yeah. So, you know, when folks pop up like, oh, here's a VHS memory, or here's a book cover that looks like it's a VHS tape. And I know that's just to like bring back 80s memories. But to me, that's 90s memories because, you know, we go to not Blockbuster Video. We were a Hollywood Video family. But
ooh, I was both. So both. No allegiances.
I think what's supposed to be finite 80s does bleed into 90s, but I don't know. The 90s are also, I think, a very existential decade because it's that, you know, period between Cold War and 9/11, but where everything seemed to be going okay. But you also had the internet coming along, you had cloning, you had all this other stuff that I think put people in this place of like questioning of something more existential, that hey, maybe there's something bigger than us. You know, Y2K coming up and everything.
Yeah, I was gonna say that about Y2K. It's like before we kind of, I mean, granted, it's like other generations had their own disasters and everything, but you know, before we hit 9/11, it was like kind of Y2K was like, is this gonna be the end of the world? Like, what is that? What does that mean? And like, we were kind of like faced this weird like a pre-apocalypse almost, which was kind of unique to the 90s for sure.
Yeah, it does seem like kind of I keep saying an existential decade that we were kind of searching for something really big for an answer, and we didn't know, because up until that point our questions had been answered, our conflicts were done, and now we had, you know, internet, James Webb telescope, all these other things are just opening up, and it actually seemed like maybe we're on track to a Star Trek like, you know, reality or something. That, you know, of course none of that happened in the end, but
Some people might argue that some of it's like that. It's all just like, I don't know, space travel, AI, all that kind of thing. I think like the invention of the internet is incorrect, but like the like mainstream use of the internet was up and coming around that time. So like to have the internet in your home, I love seeing like, I obviously I tapped into that in my own story, but like, I think that is like ripe for horror. Like that's kind of the birth of like misinformation. And it's also like, you can talk to anybody around the world, but like, who are you really talking to? And it also, like, I'd be curious to know, like, how, like, if conspiracy theories took off around the same time. Because, like, you were saying, like, we had answers before, but the answers were curated. And then once we were on the internet, we kind of had free reign to, like, explore different ideas a little bit more, maybe. I'm just spewing.
I think the 90s as, like, the 70s, and it seemed like every 20 years, we also have, like, a great upheaval of transition. And so in the, you know, in the 70s, we had a big transition with regards to our music, the fact that we were going from 8-track, you know, to CD, which really improved tape. And yeah, and records, and that really improved our musical experience, that allowed us to kind of focus in on this new musical medium. And I think the 90s is another decade of transition. Like Nick was saying, how the 80s kind of bled into the 90s. But as you were saying, Chelsea, the fact that, you know, we also had the rise of internet and the World Wide Web, being able to actually go and look up things for ourselves. You know, I grew up in the 80s, and, you know, other than looking at encyclopedias or going to the library and things like that, really didn't have a venue to really, you know, discover what was going on media wise and an understanding of like who the various musical people were, because you didn't really have that kind of, you know, kind of way to just pop on the internet and go look up Madonna and things like that. You know, it was actually going and out and buying a magazine. Well, if you can afford a magazine, you weren't doing that. You were kind of thumbing as you were, you know, checking out at the grocery store. So I think there is kind of this transition that was happening in the 90s that make it a little more difficult to identify with, just because it is a decade in transition.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah. When we were just talking to you about like other things that are kind of coming up that are tapping into that nostalgia, I don't know if you've seen this show. It's not horror, but Pen 15 on Hulu is like made for people my age. It's like, I think it takes place technically in 2000, but like obviously they grew up in the 90s, but it is this like perfect, like we didn't have cell phones yet, so we weren't like that connected, but we did have internet, so like we were getting into websites we shouldn't have been on at that age, and like, you know, like getting ourselves into a little bit of trouble. So yeah, it was an interesting time to grow up. It's like access to information, but not an overload like we get, because we didn't have social media. We just had Ask Jeeves and chat rooms. And if you wanted to use the phone, you were getting kicked offline. Like,
that's right. Those GeoCity websites that were just one long, huge page that you just kept scrolling through, and you'd have the forms to look at, and you just
web rings.
Lots and lots of dialogue out there.
Sign people, my guest book.
Yeah, people making.
Yeah.
On a global,
it did become this like new way of like self-expression too, like even just like chatting online, and you make like your little profile and your away messages and like, you know, your fonts and your song quotes, and yeah, it was kind of an interesting like early expression of that. I don't know.
Yeah.
No. I think you're 100% right, because you know all that's homogenized now. You know, what's your customability on Twitter and Facebook and social media? You know, you could put a banner up and a different picture as your icon. While I didn't actually use MySpace, but it sounds like MySpace was the last vestige of folks having, you know, this is who I am. Let me represent who I am through, you know, the magic of the internet, through, you know, HTML coding and all this other weird stuff. You know, that's gone. I mean, the art of the website is gone. And, you know, I feel bad about that because I like websites. I still maintain my website every other week.
Oh, good for you. Mine was built on a template. I'll admit it here. I was just like, this one's cute. Good enough. Like, so yeah, you're right. My self-expression was just relegated to some designer who hopefully got paid for their template on Squarespace. So thank you. But yeah, I don't know. I think there's a lot to be mined, especially in the horror genre. Like there's lots of unknowns still out there, but like a curiosity that was kind of inherent to the area or the time of the era is what I meant to say.
Coinciding and kind of expanding on that topic, I mean, we spoke earlier about some of the different movies that were coming out in the 90s. Scream, I Know What You Did Last Summer. Chelsea, what kind of media from the 90s do you feel has had an impact on your writing? And if so, how?
This is a hard question to answer, but it's a good question. Given that I was so young then, I don't know that I could say that any of the stuff I was consuming then impacted my writing, maybe, but I don't know that I could say for certain. But like thinking back to that time of like maybe what like sparked my interest in horror and just kind of like spooky, weird stuff. Like some things that came to mind were Real Monsters. Like I loved that show. Courage the Cowardly Dog was another cartoon that was just like, I feel like it was almost like X-Files for kids at the time, like just a strange show. I guess you could even say the same a little bit of like Rocko's Modern Life, just like very bizarre. Are You Afraid of the Dark? I loved that show. I think it was on Nickelodeon.
Sick.
Yes. Yeah, that was creepy. And then obviously Goosebumps falls into that category as well. I wasn't even a huge reader of that time. So to me, it was a lot of TV and movies. I feel like almost every movie I looked up where I was like, this was a formative horror movie for me was like 2002. And I was like, damn it, I need some 90s answers. But some that came to mind, like it's 99, but the Blair Witch Project was like that. I, to this day, I love found footage. And I'm like, that was the first one that I saw. So, that was great. I definitely saw things like Silence of the Lambs and It way too young. So I'll throw those in there. What else? Oh, The Sixth Sense. Like M. Night Shyamalan probably just kind of deserves his own genre at this point. But that sort of like dark twist that has been worked in through the whole thing and you don't realize till the end, like that was really great. So I think these are some examples of things that like got me interested in just like dark, weird stuff at a young age. Like I've just kind of always been a little bit bent towards that type of media. I didn't start writing until lockdown. So, I mean, I wrote like in high school, but never like I was good at writing in high school, but I didn't do it as a hobby. So I didn't start until I was well into adulthood. At that point, I think my influences probably like varied a lot. And I even think I'm still kind of finding my voice a little bit. Like some people I love, like I love Clive Barker. I wouldn't dare compare myself to him, but he's phenomenal. I think I do have a little bit of maybe a more commercial voice than like an art house voice, if we were to say that. Like I'm probably more of a Blumhouse writer than an A24 writer. I do love a well-done like thriller. Like I love Caroline Kepnes's work, You, which is now a show. Samantha Colesnick's stuff is amazing. I love how bleak she writes. I don't know, just kind of like, I just love reading new people and like it. I'll pick up something. I'm like, I really like that. Let me try something in that style and like put my own voice on it. And I was recently telling somebody, I was like, my writing will either make you like laugh, want to throw up or cry. Like there's like no real in between. It's like either gonna like really break your heart or like really gross you out. So I don't know. I'm kind of all over the place with that answer, but I don't know that I have a definitive one.
No, that's helpful. And I think it's representative of, again, growing up in a decade that was in transition.
With lots of media to consume. Cause there's also video games and you know, other stuff. True. Oh man, I think I played too many video games growing up.
Yeah, and we had like weird like E-bombs world and like rotten.com. like we were just looking at shit we should not have been looking at like as a young kid, so who knows what of that seeped into my psyche.
So transitioning a bit from editing work to writing work, which we've just kind of touched on a little bit, you have a story in the collection called Who in the World's the Hat Man? So why don't you tell us about your story and what was your, you know, catalyst to write this specific story?
So the catalyst, like, this isn't a story that I was sitting on and then the 90s theme arrived and I was like, yes, I already have something. We decided on the theme and I started brainstorming at that point. And I went through a ton of different ideas. I was like, oh, I'm going to write about an evil Tamagotchi. And at one point I was like, oh, I had another idea that was like, oh, shoot, I'm not going to remember what it was. But my idea is like, every other week I was like committing to something else and I was like getting frustrated at myself. And then I kind of just backed up and slowed down, which I need to do a lot of times with my brain. And I have horrible sleep patterns. Like, I don't DM me with advice. I've taken it all. Like, I get it. I understand sleep hygiene. I just have bad sleep. but sleep paralysis is something I experience from time to time. Which if you are a person who gets sleep paralysis, can be absolutely terrifying. Especially if you don't know what's happening in the first like few times that you get it. So I was kind of like, oh, I wonder if there's a story here. And then I don't remember why I landed on it, but I was like, what about Carmen Sandiego? Like, that's so 90s. Like, I used to come home from school and watch it on TV. And like, there's this phenomenon with sleep paralysis that people see a figure in a hat. And I was like, how funny would it be? This is probably a spoiler for my story. How funny would it be if Carmen Sandiego was the hat man? Because she has a big hat. And I like kind of just like went from there, but that was the catalyst. I was like, Carmen Sandiego is the hat man. She's trademarked, so I need to make her something else. Like, I don't know, Alejandra El Dorado or whatever the heck I called her. But that was the like catalyst for that story. It took like a real world fear, kind of placed it in the 90s, vaguely addressed like a 90s icon, and gave her this like lore. And this is what came out of it.
Well, that's cool. And I think that, I mean, I think most people know who Carmen Sandiego is, even if you haven't watched the show. So, you know, that was a great hook to kind of use her as a template. Now, I know that I'm always thinking about, you know, what voice perspective. Mm-hmm. And your story is in second person perspective, you know, mostly found like in choose your own adventure books. Can you talk a little bit about your decision, you know, shifting away from the more typical first or third person and deciding to do a second person perspective?
Sure. I think this was the first time, excuse me, that I tried writing in second person. I just mentioned that one of my like writing heroes is Caroline Kepnes. Her whole like signature series is told in the second perspective a little bit differently than the way I used it, but I'm sure some of that influence seeped in. I think I decided to land on it when I really like was kind of preparing to write and putting myself in the mindset of a sleep paralysis state, because it's such a physical, visceral sensation that I think if you told that in first person or third person, it may not be as effective. And it's something that a lot of people don't experience. So I was like, okay, I'm putting the reader right there and I'm going to just do my best to make them feel this way that I feel. So I think that's why I landed on the second person. Mm-hmm. And I had a lot of fun trying it. Like, again, I'm still a new writer, so sometimes I just try something just to try it. I think like I definitely had a purpose behind that with that like sensation mm-hmm. view outlook on it. But yeah, I was happy with how it came out. I mean, I'm not trying to toot my own horn, but I thought it was a good story for that voice.
Oh, no, that's very insightful. It's helpful to understand, you know, your decision-making process with that and why it was so important to go with a second person voice instead of a first or a third.
A second person voice really does put, I'm going to say consumer, but that's the wrong word, but we'll go with it, consumer into the text. One of my all-time favorite movies is Lars von Trier's Europa. It came out in 1990. It takes place right at the end of World War II. They're trying to rebuild Germany. The gimmick for the film, though, is it's told as if you're being hypnotized. So the movie opens up. It's narrated by Max von Sydow. And he's saying, you know, on the count of 10, you will be in Europa. And, you know, the screen, all it's showing is these train tracks flashing by. And he's just counting down. And what it, you know, you can easily leave that part out. And you just have a neo-noir film. But because it's in there, I've always taken the theory of, you know, he's hypnotizing the audience of this film, putting them technically in the film, the things that are going on in the film is now happening to the viewer. So, and it's thus it makes it a second person perspective film. So I've always been a sucker for kind of gimmicky things like that. And plus, I grew up on Choose Your Own Adventure books. I have a collection of them, a huge collection of them. So when I see second person perspective, I'm like, yes.
Yeah. I haven't heard of that movie. It sounds really cool though. But as you were talking, I was even thinking, again, not in the 90s, but I was disappointed that, but The Ring was like a formative horror experience for me for sure. Like one of the ones I saw in theaters, probably before I was 13. But that's another one where it's found footage, but because the whole thing is like it's being passed down. Now you watched it, right? So now you are like part of the lore and the carrying it on, which I think is why I found that so effective as a kid. I think it holds up though. I did watch it recently and I was like, this movie's pretty good still. And I am talking about the American one, not the Japanese one.
Well, The Ring, yeah, American Ring, that's very early 2000s. I mean, it's still basically 90s, but yeah, just like Scream opened up the door. I mean, Ring opened up the doors for J-horror and basically, you know, had a huge influence for the next decade or so.
Yeah, and anything that's early 2000s would have been greatly influenced by the 90s. So I think that's very...
Yeah, Ring's 90s movie. You're good.
We're counting it. Yeah, the things I was like, oh my God, The Ring. I was like, Signs weirdly scared the shit out of me. That's me and my husband fight over Signs all the time. He's like, that movie was shit. And I was like, no, that movie was so good.
I think it was awesome.
Thank you.
That's Spence and others. I mean, he was doing things that no one else was that made it really unique, really stood out, especially his early stuff. And I just like, no, it had its place. There was a reason for it.
I agree with you. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Saw was another one, like a little bit more body horror, but I think that was in early 2000s as well. But all of those, it was like, my parents finally were like, fine, we'll just buy you the movie ticket, just go. I'm like, I can't buy it. I'm not 13. I don't even know how we got on this tangent. Sorry.
Well,
oh, second person perspective.
Always good to talk about our inspirations and whatnot. But, you know, people who write also inspire others. And even though you said, you know, you're still early in your writing career, came out through the pandemic, you already got, you know, I think you've got some drabbles out there, short stories out there. You've got an entire edited anthology that you put together. I mean, those are goals for a lot of people. So congrats.
Thank you so much. That's really kind of you.
But two, it begs the question, what is next for Chelsea Pumpkins?
Oh, boy. this is another like lesson learned. Putting your brain in editor/project manager mode and then putting it back in writing mode, very difficult for me, at least, to do. I would say it took me maybe like 6 months to like get back into the writing habit. So that was like a little bit frustrating because I just didn't foresee it coming. So I was like, I really want to write, but like, I'm just not feeling it. So I just recently cranked out a couple of new short stories. So I'm excited about that. I'm just like happy to be writing again, you know, like I don't even care where they go. I'm just happy about it. But in terms of stuff coming out, my most recent publication is a story called Forever Home, and that's in Howls from the Wreckage. That was edited by Christopher O'Halloran, and the foreword was written by Nick Cutter. My story in that takes place during a flood, and the character gets separated from their pet as cat lovers. I don't know that I can promise I recommend it, but my whole thing was like, what is my personal disaster? And it's getting separated from my pets. So that's what I tapped into for that. So that's already out. And then I mentioned earlier, Reader Beware is like an R.L. Stine homage. And I was fortunate enough to get accepted into that. So I have a story in that. I didn't realize it at first that it's like very heavily inspired by Texas Chainsaw Massacre. But then like read it back and I was like, oh my God, you obviously like were thinking of this movie when you wrote this. But kind of just a slasher story that I enjoyed writing. Other than that, I'll be in Ruth Anna Evans is putting together a anthology of girls coming of age horror. So I have a story in that. It's called the anthology is called Dark Blooms. So that was one of the projects I just finished up, which was fun. So I would say like that was another story that was inspired by like early 2000s for me, because that's when I was coming of age, 90s, 2000s. So other than that, hopefully just keep writing more. I have a novella outline that my friends keep hounding me to turn into a novella, but I have not sat down and done it yet. So we'll see. And I also am a co-host of a podcast, so I can relate to the type of work y'all are doing. And I know it, like, I don't know, it's amazing to be able to talk to creators and help promote them. So I really appreciate the work that you're doing. I'm so happy you brought me on. But that is another project that keeps me busy in a really fun way. So I'm happy to be a part of that. That's Cutthroat Queens podcast.
Well, Chelsea, thank you so much for coming on and hanging with us on our podcast. Again, we're wishing you continued success and also, you know, more accolades and whatnot for, that's what I call horror.
Yes. Tell your friends about it. Buy it. It's great. I hope you all have fun reading it. Like, I just think it's a fun anthology. Some stories are serious. Some are a little bit more silly, all kinds of subgenres. But yeah, so I'm glad it's out there and that people are still talking about it. So thank you.
And that concludes our transmission for this episode. We'd like to thank P.L. McMillan for providing this episode's bumper. We had the honor of interviewing Plim last November about her novella, Sisters of the Crimson Vine. If you haven't listened, please check out our archives. We wish Plim continued success. And then other folks of projects, we'd like to take this opportunity to discuss what we've got going on. So, Michelle, I hear we've got a convention coming up that we're going to.
We do. It's called CocoCon, and it is a convention that we went to last year where we served as panelists. And before we talk about this year's, Nick, why don't you give a brief explanation of what CocoCon is?
It's basically an old school fan convention, sort of like the ones that you had back in the 60s through the 80s. You know, more low-key affairs, you know, guests of honor come in, talk shop on fantasy, sci-fi, other speculative fiction things. So this is a fairly new con in Phoenix. I think this is its third year. I think COVID kind of set things awry. And I think it's also kind of the offshoot of some other local fan conventions as well. But yeah, just... Not a Comic-Con, not a big event like that, but, you know, kind of an old-school classic fan convention.
Yeah, more intimate affair. It's always held on Labor Day weekend, so this year it starts on Friday evening, September 1st, and runs through Monday, September 4th. And it will be held at the DoubleTree by Hilton Phoenix in Tempe. Nick and I are on three panels that we are moderating. The first one is From EC Comics to Shudder, Horror Comics That Excite and Scare Us. That'll be on Saturday. On Sunday, we have Creepy Crawly Otherworldly Bumps in the Night, or Cosmic Horror Films. And that's on Sunday. And then on Monday, we have a panel on Weird West in Popular Culture. So anybody that's in the Phoenix area or has an interest in attending a more intimate conference and would love to meet some really great folks that are in the Phoenix area, not just us, do consider, attending this convention. We will have a link in the show notes below. Next we have,
well, we also will be vending as well. This is our first time.
Oh, I forgot that.
It's the first time we've ever vended at a convention before, you know?
That's right.
Michelle and I, we've been writers for like 10 years and we've never vended. So we'll have books, you know, the Peplum book, horror book, Twilight Zone book, Stranger Things book, other books. Michelle will have her artwork that she does with journaling and scrapping and stuff. So yeah, we will even autograph stuff too.
Yes. And this is a great time to meet us if you live in this area or are planning to attend. Nick, I know you have a couple of recent things that have come out or are going to be coming out. So you'd like to talk about those?
Yeah, I forget sometimes, you know, I update my website basically every other week with my news and stuff, but there's folks out there that only know us through the podcast. So y'all sometimes don't know, aside from what's going on in the podcast, what Michelle and I are up to. We have our hands in lots of other projects too. So I have a couple essays that have been published in the past, I'm going to say 3 months. I don't need to go back too much further. I have an essay that just came out in the new issue of Weird Tales in their cosmic horror issue. I have an essay about the origins of cosmic horror and Lovecraftian horror in the old 1920s and 30s issue of Weird Tales. There's a new horror literary magazine called Dead Dark Things, and they're releasing their second issue, and I have an essay on that. I've turned one of my old conference presentations, which was a René Girard reading of Lovecraft's Call of Cthulhu, into essay format, and it's found a home there. So I'm excited for that. And Michelle, you've got an essay that's slated to be published later this year.
I do. It's one that I wrote back during the pandemic, and like many things, many writing projects, they kind of, you know, got stalled a little bit and then, you know, take off again. And I'm excited to announce that A Vindication of Monsters, Essays on Mary Wollstonecraft and Mary Shelley, edited by Claire Fitzpatrick, is now up for pre-order at Amazon. It'll be releasing on October 15th. I happen to have an essay on Bernie Wrightson. He was a comic book artist. He worked in films and I think television. He was just an incredible artist. And in my essay, I actually talk about and discuss his 50 illustrations that he did as visual accompaniment to Mary Shelley's novel, of course, Frankenstein. So we'll have links in the show notes for all of these projects. And I think, Nick, you have one more thing.
Yeah. Y'all probably know that we appear as guests from time to time on the Fan to Fan podcast. And if y'all also remember, I think a couple months ago, we had Bernie Gonzalez, a comic book author and writer and artist from the Fan to Fan podcast on our show to talk about his comic book series, Midnight Mystery. But Michelle and I, we've recorded a lot of episodes of Fan to Fan with the cool guys over there that they'll be coming out sporadically. The newest one, I did a sit down to talk about one of my favorite Italian gothic horror films, Castle of Blood. So that should be released, I don't know, in the near future. So, you know, keep an eye or ear out for that. And do subscribe to the Fan to Fan podcast. That's a great podcast that, you know, it's fans and other folks talking about pop culture, mostly film, but sometimes TV and comics and other stuff.
Yeah, and right now they've been doing kind of a long-form series on 3D movies from the 1980s. And I know we were talking to Pete the other day, the co-host, and rather surprised how many 1980s films that were 3D. So if you have any interest in 80s 3D films, or just kind of wonder, wow, are there really that many? Definitely go over and check out Fan to Fan. They're a great podcast program and well worth a listen to. Well, with that, we'll finish up this program with just our social media details. If you'd like to contact us to be a guest on Transmissions, we're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Our website is hplovecast.com. And of course, you can also email us at hplovecast@gmail.com. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and feel free to explore our archives. Consider supporting us by purchasing our books. We each have Amazon author pages with links to all the books we have either edited or contributed to with individual essay chapters. Or if you feel like donating a dollar or two, we do have a Ko-fi account. A link is provided in the show notes. As always, thank you for listening.